The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Bartomeu leaves Barcelona with a European Premier League mic drop. Manchester City and Liverpool cruise in the Champions League, but it's far from a fab night for Klopp, with defensive deputy Fabinho limping off to join VVD on the sidelines. We'll round up the rest of last night's results for free and debate the Premier League's PR push-pull as they continue to ignore the public mood on PPV. Plus, we'll speculate where Max has gone on his mini-break. All that and more on today's Guardian Football Weekly. OK, we have a panel, as ever. Now then, Barry Glendenning, I feel as if I got a bit of a glimpse into your morning routine, raving as we came on Zoom.
I wouldn't say raving. I had some music on. Was it Chase and Status, I think the young people call them.
Has it got you in the pumped up mood then?
I'm always pumped. I'm like a coil spring, Faye.
Excellent stuff. Are you like a coiled spring, Flo Lloyd Hughes, after being at AFC Wimbledon last night?
Yeah, I would be lying if I told you I felt the freshest this morning. It was a chilly one. We're getting into the very cold stage of the season. But yeah, you know, I'm not feeling too bad, so I'm ready.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. Nick Ames, I did see you at the Emirates on Sunday. I waved, you blanked me. Have we got a problem?
Yeah, let's take it outside. I didn't see you, Faye. Otherwise, I would have exchanged a very cordial wave in response.
I don't believe you. Sid Lowe with us as well. It's a good job that Max did tell you we were moving today's pod to Wednesday, really, isn't it?
Has it
been a bit busy?
It was bizarre because I was at the Atletico Madrid game last night and finally managed to start watching it kind of 5 or 10 minutes into the second half and thought, well, actually, this game's quite good, isn't it? I wish I'd realised that sooner. Because, of course, at the same time, Real Madrid were playing Borussia Mönchengladbach. And more importantly, at the same time, Bartomeu was resigning as president of Barcelona. By the way, in terms of Nick not recognising you, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't recognise anyone anymore with masks on. I was actually talking to someone the other day at, I don't know what you call these things, a memorial event, a celebration event. And I was talking to someone. And she seemed very distracted and not very keen to talk to me, which I thought, well, that's fair enough, you know, in these kind of environments. And about 2 hours later, she came back to me and said, I'm really sorry. When I was talking to you earlier, I hadn't realised who it was because of the mask, which I thought was a fairly weak excuse. I think she knew exactly who she was talking
to. It's a very useful excuse, isn't it? If you're feeling antisocial, you just stick your head down and pretend that you don't know who it is.
Exactly.
I love
right.
it. So you touched on it. Big news coming out of Spain last night. Club president Barcelona, Josep Bartomeu, has resigned. Come on then, Sid. What exactly was the straw that broke the camel's back?
Well, you know, look, in a way, I mean, this is the thing. You refer to it being a straw, and that's the point, is that this wasn't news, in a sense. And this was going to happen one way or the other. It was either going to happen by him being beaten in the vote of no confidence, which almost certainly he would have been beaten. I think it would have been an absolute miracle for him to have come through that, even though he only needed a third of the vote. Had he got through that, he would have almost certainly lost presidential elections, which were set for the middle of March. So he would have gone then anyway. You're asking about the straw that broke the camel's back. Essentially, or at least the reason that was put forward was that they were trying, Barcelona's board were trying to gain themselves an extra couple of weeks for this no confidence vote, which to be honest, doesn't make a huge amount of sense. But they were claiming that they wanted to do this because in times of pandemic, they needed to have a whole series of special measures and they needed the time to set all of this up. The local government or the Catalan government said, no, you know, you've got a series of dates. It has to be done within this time. You've got to go and do it. And they said last night, and it was very interesting having Bartomeu come out and basically resign, but at the same time saying it's not our fault, it's theirs, said they were irresponsible, trying to make us do it, trying to put all of our members through the same location. This isn't the right way of doing it. And so we're walking away because the statutes basically tell us to. Why he's actually done it, I must admit, I don't fully understand, because I don't really understand why he was clinging on to power still, given everything. But I don't fully understand why he wanted to do it now. I think that was possibly the final straw, in so much as it was like, right, listen, this is it. You know, everyone wants us to go. We just walk now. I think he wanted to get a couple of things sorted out before he went. I remember, I don't know when this was now, because so much has happened and so you know, he's been on the verge of going, or we've been discussing whether or not we go for so long. But I remember saying some time ago now that he was like that dreadful Yellow Pages advert where the young guy's had a party at his house and it's a mess. And his parents phone and say, "We're on the way home." He goes, "Shit, clean this thing up before they get here," and sort of run around. And so basically trying to buy himself time to clean up the mess, because partly because there's a potential for him to be personally liable for the shortfall in the economics of the club over his mandate. And as you say, he went with one of the most amazing mic drops you could ever imagine.
Yeah, we'll get to the mic drop in a minute. I just want to know where J.R. Hartley is, to be honest. Was it kind of inevitable, given what happened with Messi over the summer? And does it make Messi staying a bit more likely?
Well, I mean, I think it does make Messi staying more likely insofar as, you know, it finally resolves this. But of course, deep down, Messi will have known that this moment was going to come sooner rather than later. Admittedly, it could have been March rather than now. It could have been in 3 weeks' time rather than now. But it was always going to come. So much so that there was an interview, a very interesting interview on the eve of the Clásico with Gerard Piqué in La Vanguardia, in which he says, "I didn't speak to Messi much during the summer, but I did send him a message in which I said, Leo, mate, in a year's time, it will be different people." So in other words, you know, Messi knew this was coming anyway. But yeah, I imagine he was probably quite pleased last night.
Sid, Bartomeu, I believe he gave a speech that lasted 35 minutes.
Yeah,
it was long. Which makes me think, I don't know if you're familiar with Father Ted, but his speech at the Golden Cleric Awards where he just settled scores and, you know, and now the liars. Was it a bit like that?
Yes, you're right. I mean, it did last 35 minutes. Put it this way, it meant that I basically didn't see any of the first half of the Atletico game because I was trying to watch it on a Zoom link. It was very much a justification, a vindication, an attack on people who have been against him. In particular, as I say, that starting point was really aimed at the Catalan government, which I think tells you that he did feel that at the end they had kind of pushed him, or that his relationship with them had pushed him over the edge, although I don't think that's the reason he goes by any means. And he picked up on, you know, some of the pressure that he's been under. You know, he said, "We've been insulted. My family's been insulted." There was very much a kind of a thread of, if you like, victimism running through all the way through it. A thread of, "We've done brilliant things," explaining the things they've done or trying to claim that the things they've done. You know, this is the most successful era in the club's history. And then he was saying, he actually directly addressed this issue that we were saying about, "Why didn't you go sooner?" He said, "Well, because after the 8-2, the easy thing would have been to have gone. It would have been easy for us to walk away, but there was a transition to be had. We needed to resolve the future." And this is, I mean, you know, this sums it up in a way. "We had to resolve the future of the greatest player in history, Messi." You think, well, hang on a minute, mate. One way to have resolved that at that time might have been to have walked away then and said, "Here, fine, you have your club and I'm leaving." He said, "We didn't want to leave that in the hands of what do you call this in English? Like an administration, like a temporary administration." He said, "You couldn't do that," whereas actually temporary administrations have done things before, like, for example, signing Arda Turan a few years ago, which didn't exactly go very well. And he said, "We couldn't leave it in their hands, so we had to see this transition through. We were doing this for the good of the club, and this is why we wanted to continue to do it now. And the proof that we didn't want to cling on to power was that we called elections for March, which was the soonest possible date to do so."
Yeah, Flo, you tweeted last night about Bartomeu with his mic drop, obviously this little leaving present for the fans, announcing that the board had agreed to join a European Premier League. It would still need to be voted on by the members. Sid, is this idea any more popular in Spain than it is over here?
No, it's not popular at all. I don't think it's had quite the degree of backlash that it's had in England, but it's not popular at all. In fact, curiously, it's not curious at all. It's entirely logical. Logically enough, the person who's been most vociferous about it is the president of the Spanish League, Javier Tebas, who is very bullish about everything he talks about, but has been particularly bullish about this. He described it as a phantom league last night. He described it the first time it came out as being the kind of thing that comes out from a bunch of blokes at a bar at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, they're all pissed up. "Tell you what, let's have a European Super League. Oh, good idea. Brilliant. Let's do this." As you say, it would still have to be ratified by Barcelona's members in a members assembly, which is sometime in the future. We don't know when yet. And not only that, of course, it's signing up to a proposal, which isn't actually a reality just yet. So, I mean, there's lots of ways of looking at this. One of them is, I did think to myself, that, you know, this was Bartomeu basically saying, "Right, you can have your club back. Oh, and by the way, I've signed you up for a Super League thing. Bye now." Shutting the door and walking out. I go, "Hey, see you later." And quite apart from all the other things, I did think last night, I wonder what the other clubs involved in this feel about this, because they've all been very secretive, very quiet about this, kind of sneaking around behind people's backs. And Bartomeu looks at this and thinks, ah, sod it, I'm going. I'm going to let this one out the bag. And you just wonder how they feel about it. Now, obviously, there's a simple answer to that, which was, who gives a toss how they feel? But it can't have pleased them very much.
Yeah, very much. Well, La Liga boss Javier Tebas tweeted, unfortunate for Bartomeu making a statement on his last day about Barcelona joining a weak and imaginary competition, which would be their ruin. It confirms his ignorance about the football industry. A sad end for a president with successes and lately many mistakes. Nick Ames, what's your opinion on that?
I mean, that's quite an indictment, isn't it? And quite a way to see him off. I mean, I think Sid said it. He's clearly kind of going down in flames, isn't he? By lighting a match and then stepping back and seeing how it all takes off. But it sounds to me like it's not a goer, and there would be so much opposition there, as there would be here. And it seems like the flailing act of a slightly desperate man at this point.
Yeah, Flo, Breno on Twitter said, should Messi just be Barcelona's next president? I mean, at this point, he might as well be.
Yeah, and I'm sure in the future, it's probably a role that he's got his sights set on. But yeah, what a way to burn as many bridges as you can in the space of 35 minutes. So let's see, the aftermath of that is going to be pretty big, and I'm sure Sid will be reporting on it for the weeks ahead with great glee.
I will look forward to that. Thanks.
Well, listen, while we have you, Sid, I mean, I know you didn't actually get to watch very much of the game, but you were at Atleti last night. Marcos Llorente scoring again. Didn't he used to be a defensive midfielder?
Yeah, it's amazing his transformation, and it feels like it really suits him in this kind of team. He's a defensive midfielder who's main qualities, I mean, he's a good player, but his main qualities is his athleticism, his ability to cover a lot of ground. He's very, very quick. But Diego Simeone, and obviously this speaks to Arsenal's decision to sign Thomas Partey, by the way. Diego Simeone always felt with Marcos Llorente that he wasn't reliable enough positionally, whereas Thomas is, you know, in terms of holding the position, in terms of knowing where to be. And that while he had these qualities, he couldn't quite see how this would work in a defensive role. And then basically because they're in a position where they had to find solutions to temporary problems, Llorente gets pushed into this sort of forward position, kind of just off the forward position, where that running is, it no longer matters if you're not quite as well positioned, because it's about bursting into the space rather than about trying to hold your position. And suddenly think, wow, this works quite well. And then, of course, in fairness to Simeone, it's not purely fluke. He sees this in an option, tries it, and then starts working with Llorente on different types of movements, different types of positioning. And so far, the signs are really, really good. And I think they need to be for Atletico, because the truth is they haven't got a lot up front. Of course, they signed Luis Suarez in the summer, but Alvaro Morata has gone. Diego Costa is now injured. And one thing that we all know that Suarez doesn't have anymore, never really did have a huge amount, but definitely doesn't have now, is that ability to run beyond defences. And so now I think that there's almost this idea that what you do is you play a role where Suarez holds the position and others play off him, and you get someone like Llorente who's got the legs to go beyond him and make a lot happen. He was very, very good indeed last night. Although in fairness, it's also true that the best player on the pitch last night by some way was João Félix, who was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic player. Real went 2-0 down against Borussia Mönchengladbach as well. Marcus Thuram, son of Lilian, of course, with both goals there. Grant Wall pointed out on Twitter that Lilian Thuram has a son who's a striker, while Zinedine Zidane and Jürgen Klinsmann's sons are professional goalkeepers, which I love little weird stats like
is,
that.
Is that. That's family rebellion, isn't it? That's
yeah.
Kicking back against the power.
What happened to Schmeichel? Didn't quite go the same. Late goals from Benzema and Casemiro, though, meaning Real at least have 1 point after two games, which is something.
Yeah, and very, very important. I mean, obviously, it's very important in terms of the position in the group, because bear in mind, it's not just that they'd lost the first game. They'd lost the first game at home to Shakhtar, who in theory were the team that the other three would have thought, right, they're the ones we're likely to get. And I know it doesn't work like this always, but they're the ones we're likely to get the most points from. So Madrid had dropped points and been beaten in theoretically the easiest of the six games to win. And so they were up against it. Had they been beaten last night, then genuinely, I know it's only two games in, they would have been looking at that group and thinking, wow, there's a chance we don't get out of this. And so mathematically, I think last night's draw was really big for them. And I think emotionally it was as well, because, of course, they come off the back of two defeats in a row before beating Real Madrid, beating Barcelona in the Clásico. And so I think that kind of emotional push and boost that the Clásico had given them would have probably pretty much disintegrated had they been beaten last night.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant stuff, Sid. Thank you. I'll let you get back to your what's going to be potentially busy however long.
Yeah, it may well be.
Awesome. Thank you. Cheers, Sid.
Cheerio.
Right, that's it for part one. In part two, we'll round up the rest of last night's Champions League and Football League action. Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly. So there was some other Champions League action going on as well, of course. Marseille 0, Manchester City 3 at the Velodrome. Raheem Sterling back in the goals after a couple of chances missed against West Ham. He was back on form, Barry.
Yeah, it was a very good performance by City in general. Sterling in particular was excellent. I mean, they are better than Marseille. There's no getting around that. But I did see, I think it was French Football News on Twitter, describe Marseille's performance as gutless, which I thought was a little bit harsh. They obviously set up very defensively, tried to soak up the pressure, went a goal down and continued trying to soak up pressure just in the hope that they might nick a late goal, and that didn't happen. So I suppose you could say that... you know, if you're going to set up defensively and still get lose 3-0, you might as well try and attack a bit. They looked okay on the ball at times, but I think the 3-0 scoreline flattered them. City, very aggressive on the ball, very aggressive off the ball, very patient as they waited, you know, tried to break through the Marseille defence. And I think... Andre Villas-Boas, our old friend from the Premier League, said it best after the game when he said, if Marseille had money, you would have Guardiola in his possession game. But sadly for you, it is Andre Villas-Boas and his tactical decisions. So they were well beaten, and it was very, very good performance from a City team who have looked a bit off the pace in recent weeks.
Yeah, they had to mount a response. I was particularly impressed actually by Phil Foden on the left flank there. I know he's played there now and then and not always convinced, but I think maybe he's starting to realise that he can use his central midfield skills to good effect out there. And there was one incident that I think has been clipped quite a lot online this morning and last night, where he brought down this ball from the sky out on the left side. Absolutely beautiful. Did well for the second goal, but I think he chipped it across and it was headed back for Ilkay Gundogan. So that was, I think, a real positive on their display. I thought Ferran Torres did quite well playing up top as well. We still don't know that much about him, but in England anyway. But he's done well in Europe so far. Got a little bit of height, a little bit of pace. They're going to need that until Aguero and Jesus are back. They're going to have to improvise a bit. And I think what we saw last night is that Guardiola does have options. And I think City are lacking strikers, lacking an orthodox goal scorer. But I think they've got enough that if they keep ticking the games off, they should have too much for most. And I think Torres did well, Foden did well, and it kind of felt a bit group stage by numbers, really, that game. It was one where they did enough comfortably.
Yeah, I also think with a lot of these games, it's going to be really hard for the home side, especially a team like Marseille with a stadium like the Velodrome, where you get so much from the fans, and it's a stadium specifically designed for noise and to create atmosphere. So when you're a home side who's up against it a little bit already, you need that so much. And I think in the Champions League this season, yeah, we've seen a few upsets already, but I think it's going to be a challenge for some of those home sides. I've been to the Velodrome, went there during the Euros, which was fairly soon after it was renovated, and it was crazy noise-wise. The energy you get from the sides of that stadium is amazing. So I just think it's going to be really tough for teams like Marseille to find that energy when you're playing a team like Man City and they're dominating possession and everything. So I guess it's going to make life even harder as well in the group stages, and then when we get into the knockouts, if there's fans by that point. Obviously, we've got some countries and cities already having fans. And I think with the Russian teams, you've seen it having a really big impact, especially when I've watched highlights of that with the noise and some pockets of France. So it'd be great if by the time we reach the knockout stages, more countries are sort of on an even playing field, and then we can see a bit of that home advantage coming in.
Yeah, they're definitely missed, aren't they? Hashtag let fans in. Liverpool 2, FC Michelin 0. Jota and a Salah penalty for Jurgen Klopp's side. Another goal for Diogo Jota after he scored at the weekend. But there was a bit of bad news for Jurgen Klopp, as if he needed any more. Fabinho went down with a hamstring injury in the first half. I mean, he was already deputising for Virgil van Dijk, who's out, we think, probably for the, well, definitely the rest of the season by the looks of it, with an ACL. I mean, it leaves them really stretched at the back. They've got West Ham coming up at the weekend, Nick.
Yeah, I guess, has anyone got Dejan Lovren's phone number? Because they are short of cover. We've got to hope that Fabinho isn't out for too long. They are stretched, and I think it's going to be one of those where attack might be the best form of defence for them over the coming weeks. So, I mean, what we saw last night, they weren't up against a fantastic attacking unit. They did concede a couple of chances. I mean, there was one right at the start from the forward, wasn't there, when he maybe let the ball bounce rather than took it on. There was another good chance at the end that they missed. So quite clearly, teams will now think Liverpool can be got at. I think the guy last night who I don't want to say got them out of jail, so I think it was ultimately quite comfortable, but the guy who really spurred them on was Trent Alexander-Arnold, really. Fantastic assist as well for the first goal, involved in the second. And we talk about Salah, Mane, Van Dijk, but he's massive for them now. He's one of those guys who, when he's not in the team, you really feel it. So I think, yeah, I think there were pluses and minuses to come out of that game. Jota, as we've just said, is such a natural footballer as well. I love watching him. I just think he gets it. He's tactically very good too. I think you have to be to flourish under Nuno at Wolves like he did. But yeah, Fabinho being out is going to be a massive problem. I don't really know what they do with that. And they just have to struggle on and hope it's not for too long.
Reece Williams came on for Fabinho last night and did quite well, but he's a kid. He's only got a handful of appearances, for senior appearances under his belt. Do they give him a chance? I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold got a chance once when Nathaniel Clyne was injured, and look what happened there. The alternative, if Joel Matip isn't fit, seems to be to stick Millie in there, James Milner or Jordan Henderson. I don't know, but I would be inclined to give Reece Williams a chance. He may not, Jurgen Klopp may not think he's ready, but when you look at how Trent Alexander-Arnold blossomed when he got his opportunity, you know, maybe it's worth a go.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, he's only 19 years old, but he's been at Liverpool's academy since the under-10s and only made his debut in the Carabao Cup back in September against Lincoln, played alongside Virgil van Dijk that night as well. So you'd think that he would have got, you know, some decent experience and encouragement there. And I think he was on loan at Kidderminster last season, Flo.
Yeah, he was. I mean, Barry makes a good point. Sometimes you need to throw people into the thick of it and see what sticks. I think a lot of what I saw on Twitter last night, I think, was a bit dramatic from a lot of Liverpool fans, a lot of doom and gloom.
Really? Drama?
Yeah, I know, shock, right? I mean, if you think you've got centre-back problems, QPR's joint top scorer is a man that scored 2 own goals this season, and yesterday he practically passed it into QPR's net. So, I mean, cry me a river sometimes with this one, but I understand it's frustrating. But I also think, really, there should have been a bit more long-term planning. Obviously, Van Dijk was a big investment, but you can't expect someone to never get injured. This is a unique injury because it's one, you know, the worst practically that you can get in football because it takes you out for so long. But, you know, he spent short-term periods injured, but they need to think of having someone who's a decent backup. Obviously, the situation with Matip then adds to the issue, but it does seem perhaps there was a bit of oversight not to better prepare for some kind of situation like this unravelling. But at the same time, they've got such a fantastic academy that I'm more than sure someone like Williams can step up. Yes, obviously, Kidderminster to the Premier League is a bit of a jump, but hopefully they give him some time to bed in. And it sounds like Matip is only a few weeks away from coming back, probably too soon for the weekend. But I think they're going to be okay, guys. I think it's going to be okay.
It's what the academy's there for anyway, isn't it? It's the whole purpose of it. But I want to talk about injuries in general, really, because obviously they're only going to get worse, surely. I mean, you say it's, you know, the worst injury you can possibly get, Flo, and yet one of them for sure. But actually, I think we're going to see a lot more of these injuries this season because of the compact schedule, the lack of pre-season. You know, we found out after the weekend Sergio Aguero could be out for over a month. He's only just come back after a long layoff. Also on City's injury list, Gabriel Jesus, Aymeric Laporte, Benjamin Mendy, Nathan Ake.
I saw a stat a couple of days ago that I think muscle injuries are up 42% on what they were last year. And I think more than double, perhaps, on how they were either two seasons ago or three seasons ago. And I think managers are just going to have to rotate, use their squads like Jurgen Klopp did last night, resting his front three, which you know, if you were a Midtjylland fan, you might think, oh, that's a bit disrespectful. But I think it's just a case of needs must and getting through the games. And every Premier League club now, or almost everyone, can pretty much field two decent starting 11s. That is how it is. And it's just a case of really carefully planning ahead and managing workloads and trusting in your sports science staff as well to give you the best advice. But it's not an enviable task because it's just something that nobody in any area of any club has dealt with before, a workload like this.
And we also have the added bonus of COVID. Because I see Gab Marcotti reported last night that Lazio are down to 12 fit players, senior players, for their trip to Bruges and have had to make up the numbers by throwing six U team players into the squad. So personally, I don't think the Champions League should have been played this season because I think the idea of flying football teams and the backroom staff all over the continent is dangerous and irresponsible. And I'm not sure how much interest there is in the group stages. They're playing in front of no fans most games or very limited numbers of fans. So apart from the fact that UEFA are obliged to play it because if they don't, they'll be liable for huge amounts of money to broadcasters, I'm not sure there's really much point in playing it.
I agree with you, though. It's, you know, sometimes, you know, I know that a lot of these companies have to run money reasons, sponsorship reasons. We all understand that. However, there has to be a player welfare issue that is, you know, much more important over this, isn't there, Flo?
I am a little bit confused with the situation, because we talk about Football League perspective, and I know we've had other conversations when Premier League players have tested positive, but last night, more Millwall staff and players tested positive for COVID off the back of manager Gary Rowett testing positive. Now, the team are still going to play tonight, and I know that's because they've probably all had negative tests. But I don't understand why it's not a you all need to self-isolate thing. And I know it's caused a lot of discussion. Steve Evans at the weekend, Gillian manager, was not happy about the fact that he was playing a team that had recently played another team that tested positive for COVID. So I'm a bit worried, not only selfishly because I rely on making money from football, but I'm a bit worried about the football season unraveling quite quickly because no one seems to know what the right protocol is with isolating. It seems to be, you know, Ronaldo's not playing tonight because he's still, his COVID test is still positive. But then you've got other people who will play even though they've been training with someone that's tested positive. So it just doesn't make sense to me, and I think there needs to be some stricter rules. And even though we've had some games called off, we need to have some kind of directive to say, yes, everyone needs to isolate, sorry, the game's not happening. And I know it's going to make the fixture situation an absolute mess, but with everything that's going on in the wider country, it just doesn't make sense to me that this is still going to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get to the Football League shortly as well, Flo. Just want to finish off what happened in the Champions League last night, because Bayern Munich set a new record with their 13th consecutive win in the competition, stretching back to last season's group stages. They beat Lokomotiv Moscow 2-1. That's an incredible streak, Nick.
It's a fantastic streak. They're totally exhilarating to watch. They rode their luck once or twice last night, actually. Their opponents in Russia had a few good spells, scored a good equaliser, had a few chances on the counter, but they won it through a marvellous, I think control and volley it was by Kimmich. And they've just got players all over the pitch with such speed and technique and dynamism. And I mean, they're looking to me like the most complete European team we've seen maybe in the last 10 years.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Atalanta, though, remaining one of the more entertaining sides around, they came back from 2-0 down to draw with Ajax, Barry. That was a good one.
Yeah, I only saw extended highlights of this, but Atalanta are great fun to watch. Really exciting team. They were delighted with their draw. Gasperini afterwards was beaming, and more power to them. They're just a really fun team. Liverpool have back-to-back games against them coming up, and I am looking forward to those immensely.
Yeah, very much looking forward to it. Loads of action later on as well. Now in the Football League last night, Flo, you were obviously at AFC Wimbledon, but let's crack on with the Championship. Reading, oh my goodness me, rolling on, highly entertaining 4-2 win over Blackburn, and they, under Vlatko Paunovic, are doing superb things this season.
Yeah, they're now 7 points clear at the top. Seem unstoppable, to be honest, facing Blackburn, who are also one of the leaders in the Championship and have a fantastic squad, scoring loads of goals. Adam Armstrong having a fantastic season. He's now got 21 goals in 2020. But Reading just keep going from strength to strength. I think they've taken a lot of people by surprise, and I think the conversation now has reached, will they be able to keep this up? And I'm sure all their fans will obviously be hoping that they can, but it'll be interesting to see if they can maintain this with all the pressures, with the demands of the fixture list and COVID and everything that we've already mentioned. But yeah, they look so good at the moment, and they've just got so many players who can score goals. And for a manager who's come from international youth team football and MLS, this is a real coup for Reading, because not someone that I think a lot of people had their eye on for being a manager that would succeed in the Football League. And we know that some clubs have now had decent success with picking managers from abroad, but it's still something that a lot of EFL clubs think, oh, you need to have experience, because, you know, English Football League, it's a really unique, you know, system and everything and style. But actually, we're seeing more and more managers come over. Barnsley are now on their third choice from Germany or Austria, and have lots of success. So I think it's great for the club. And I mean, I hope they could continue this, because it's also fantastic to watch. They do slip up and like to concede goals, but last night they won 4-2, so it doesn't necessarily matter. But it will be interesting if they can sort of keep up this approach.
Luton play tonight, by the way, just in case any Luton fans are listening. We've got Nottingham Forest. But you might be listening on Thursday and know that obviously we've already won 10-0. Flo, action in qualifying in the Women's Euros as well. Bit of bad news for Wales, though.
Yeah, bad news for Wales. They lost 1-0 to Norway, which makes life difficult for them with one game to go. Northern Ireland beat Belarus, and now they're chasing Wales for that runner-up playoff spot. And Northern Ireland have two games to go. So it does seem like they're probably going to pip Wales to that runner-up spot, which is a shame, because Wales also missed out on qualifying for the World Cup, and it felt like they had a pretty decent chance under Jane Ludlow to qualify for the Euros. Obviously, England hosting, so they've already qualified. So we'll see what happens, but it's not looking great for Wales, unfortunately, but hopefully Northern Ireland are going to qualify. Scotland still technically in the hunt for a playoff spot in their group, but they lost to Finland last night, which was a less than ideal result because they're currently in third behind Portugal, but they're still in the hunt. Ireland, they've played seven, but they're only in second place by 1 point. They lost to Ukraine on Friday, which sort of put their hopes of qualifying to bed, because they got to play Germany next in their final game. They've already lost to Germany 3-0, and, you know, Germany, one of the best teams in the world, they've already qualified for the competition. So it's seeming unlikely, but if Ukraine lose to Montenegro, then Ireland might be able to retain that runner-up spot. So it, hopefully at least one of those home nations is going to qualify alongside England. But all the ones you would expect have already gone through. Netherlands are through, Germany are through, and Sweden, Denmark and Norway also went through. So big Scandi representation at the Euros in 2022.
Yeah, and obviously England will play Norway in a friendly at the beginning of December if it goes ahead. Right, that's it for part two. In part three, we'll talk PPV. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Now, we had some Premier League games on Monday night. Spurs beat Burnley 1-0. They're right in amongst it at the top. And was it not for that insane last 10 minutes against West Ham, they might actually be in number one position right now, Barry. Harry Kane giving another assist to Son, the seventh time this season. Not so Skinny Pete has tweeted us, "Harry Kane is the best player in the league. Discuss."
Is Harry Kane the best player in the league? I wouldn't necessarily agree. Certainly up there. I would argue there are better, maybe Mo Salah, maybe Son indeed. And I'm just talking specifically about forward players. But a 1-0 win against Burnley on the face of it isn't anything to get particularly excited about. But I've been really impressed by Tottenham most of the time this season, bar that aberration against West Ham, I suppose. But I think Jose Mourinho he'd be looking at what's going on around him with the other teams and maybe quietly fancying his chances of maybe winning a title with another club.
and he won't shout about it at all. He'll be very quiet on that front. Do you reckon, Nick, that any of the following records are achievable? Single season assist record. So Kane's on 8 after 6 games. The record is 20, which is shared between Thierry Henry from the 2002-03 season and Kevin De Bruyne from last season.
Absolutely. I think he'll beat that. Seriously, the amount of movement that goes on around him in that team, Son, you've got other players like Lucas as well, Bergwijn, Bale coming in. Yes, basically. I'm sure he can do that.
You'd have to say, though, that assists in a single season, obviously it's the record all kids dream of growing up. I mean, it's just the most lame-ass thing I've ever heard.
It's not. I actually think it's important. I think that is just as crucial as getting the golden boot at the end of the season.
Assists were only brought in on the back of fantasy football. Nobody gave a hoot who provided assists before that. Like, literally, nobody cared.
No, it just wasn't written down as a stat.
I disagree with Barry a little bit. I think it says a lot about a striker. And I think especially in, you know, I mean, we're past the point with Harry Kane now where anyone's doubting him or underrating him. But certainly when he came through properly 5 or 6 years ago, people thought, okay, maybe he's just a goal scorer and a runner, that kind of thing. And now the stats and the way he's playing, dropping in and being so unselfish and providing all kinds of assists, such as that twisting header the other night, I think it will add to the legend, frankly, and show what an incredible all-round performer is, and that he is so much more than a goal scorer and so much more of a player than I ever thought he'd be as well, to be honest.
Yeah, he's phenomenal, isn't he? So can he get this one, Flo? Joint single-season goal-scoring partnership with Son. They've currently got 13 between them, and the record is Sturridge and Suarez with 52 in 2013-14.
I mean, they're definitely not, because under these conditions, there's no way Harry Kane's keeping fit for that long. So I think that's going to be their downfall. But in terms of assists, I think last night, Kevin De Bruyne reached his 88th assist for City. And the first thing I thought was, wow, it'll be really cool when he gets to 100. So I value assists, Barry. I don't know why you think they're a waste of time, but I think that's pretty cool. To have 100 assists is a pretty amazing contribution to make in your time at a club.
I think Barry thinks every single stat is a complete waste of time.
Okay, put it this way. Paul Scholes' assist record is lamentable. Does that mean he was rubbish? No.
It's just a different thing to look at somebody's all-round performance, though, isn't it? I have eyes, Faye.
I don't need a list with a number. Assist.
Well, listen, I have a memory like a sieve, so I need it written down.
One thing that I really liked on Monday night was that after Son scored, which, by the way, let's credit that header, because it was I think one of the best headers you will see given the speed at which that move happened. But after he scored, he hadn't realised who had headed it onto him, and Kane ran over, and you could see Son going, "Was that you who gave me the assist?" And it sort of reminded me of playing in the playground sometimes, and maybe you've got a mate who passes to you all the time, and you pass to them, and you've got that combination, and it was just quite a fun touch that Son was so delighted when he found out it was Kane who'd headed it to him.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, producer Jax just told me that the season Thierry Henry got 20 assists, he also scored 24 goals. And that as a combination, Barry Glendening, is incredibly impressive. Now then, I've waited until the third part to bring up pay-per-view and the Premier League shenanigans, because I just didn't want to get everybody in a bad mood and start the pod off on a bad foot. But Mike Ashley, of all people, calling for it to be dropped to a fiver. It will stay at the current level, though, until at least after the international break, but maybe reviewed after that. They've made about £5 million from it so far, so probably not worth the PR car crash, Barry.
The Premier League are really not covering themselves in glory at the moment. Pay-per-view is a farce. People don't have the money. Some people do, a lot don't. People are extremely reluctant to pay it. One game, presumably West Brom Burnley, is believed to have had less than 1,000 subscribers. And at a time when many people are struggling, they're losing their jobs, they're struggling to put food on the table, to charge people extra on top of subscriptions they're already paying is just ludicrous. But this is just one of many things that the Premier League have shown they're a real tin ear for. I mean, yesterday, as per a tweet from Henry Winter, Premier League clubs were warning the government of the long-term risks to fans' mental health as a result of being denied access to games, and clubs are pointing out the devastating impact of having no fans at games, what that was having on business around grounds, pubs, bars, cafes, shops, etc. And, you know, who knew the Premier League cared so much about businesses around grounds who were selling pints that they could otherwise sell on their concourses? Who knew they were so concerned about our mental health? They've got so much wrong in recent weeks. And then there's all this nonsense over the big project, big picture. You know, they really have no idea what is going on in the real world.
Yeah, I totally agree with Barry. I think it totally stinks. And there's a lot of maybe hypocrisy in the Premier League going in on the mental health aspect there, especially when, on the other hand, the club's pricing is denying many fans the possibility to watch their own team's games on TV with that extra £15, which is a lot of money to many people. And I think during a pandemic, the mental health aspect of being able to watch your team on TV, if it has to be, for many people, is important, because we all need these punctuation points during a week at the moment, especially as many parts of the country are locked down, especially as it's very hard to go out and socialise and see friends and family. Me, as a journalist, I look at my calendar now and I think, well, at least on Thursday I'm out covering Arsenal versus Dundalk, and on Sunday I'm at Villa versus Saints, I think it is. So squeezing more money out of people to do what they should just be doing anyway is absolutely ludicrous. And I don't understand why they need to wait to make a decision on whether to scrap the costs, keep costs the same, or bring it down.
Yeah, and Barry, you talked about the Premier League not particularly covering themselves in glory, and David Conn has an exclusive in The Guardian today regarding just that, and quite a few of the clubs unhappy will be unhappy when they read it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're heading for a civil war in the Premier League. There are quite clearly six clubs there who consider themselves more powerful and are considered the 14 other clubs beneath them. And someone from those six clubs is leaking like a sieve to David Kahn anyway. So there's probably going to be fractures among the six. It's a good story. It's quite unsavory what's going on, the scheming and the duplicity and the plotting, the misleading information we're being given by people who are supposed to be in charge, accounts that don't stack up, you know, from, say, Greg Clark from the Football Association. But you'd have to say you'd really expect nothing less.
Let's go positive, shall we? Why not? Because football clubs are going to be required to meet a recruitment diversity target of 15% in new executive jobs and 25% in coaching roles under a code devised by the Football Association. So just to take you through it a little bit, 15% of new executive appointments will be from a BAME background with 30% female, 25% of new coaching appointments will be BAME and 10% of senior coaching appointments, 50% of new coaching appointments at women's football clubs will be female, with 15% BAME, and shortlists for interview will have at least one male and one female BAME candidate, provided applicants meeting the job specifications apply. This looks good, doesn't it, Flo? Does it go far enough, though?
Well, I don't think it does at all, because it's a voluntary code and you're signing up to meet targets. But as far as I'm aware and what I've looked through, and I would love to be proved wrong, there is no accountability to this. There is no policing of it. Clubs can sign up voluntarily, of which 40 clubs have signed up so far across the Football League. So we're missing 52 other clubs. Southampton didn't sign up in the Premier League, and I think their excuse for it was pretty piss poor, to be honest, and their reason for not doing it. And having worked and still working part-time for a charity that was influential in the sport for code governance and the gendered aspect of that, and the way there is some accountability to that, because governing bodies don't get funding if they don't meet it. But at the same time, all they have to do in that case is show progress towards meeting it, and they still get their money. Now, in this case, it doesn't seem like there'll be any action taken if clubs don't meet the targets they set themselves. But it's a good start-ish to give them targets in the first place and to try and influence their hiring practices. But I do think there needs to be more accountability to it. And I think it shouldn't be voluntary. I think that there should be something that is a bit more enforced, because I think we've shown time and time again that, you know, people don't volunteer very well to do these things or make those changes. And there needs to be some kind of initiative top down. But it's a very positive step, I think. And having listened to the way it was devised and the people that they spoke to and who influenced it, I think that's really positive as well. And the players who were spoken to who influenced it, I think that's really positive. But I'm interested to see how it progresses and the impact that it might have, because I'm still a little bit, you know, unsure of that.
I know you've got something to say on it, Barry, but I just want to put in exactly what Southampton did say. They say they're wholly supportive of the code's objectives, but are waiting to see how it fits in with the Premier League's own advanced equality standard before revising their recruitment processes, which they say are the culmination of a 5-year equality and diversity journey. Barry?
Yeah, I agree with Flo that it's a good idea in theory, but talk is cheap, and when it comes to act, it will, of course, upset the usual numpties who will say it's just an exercise in box ticking, and that's unfair, I think. But I wonder how many clubs actually realise what they've signed up for here. Did they read through this, or are they just going, oh, well, everyone else is doing it, we should do it? I'm reminded of the Rooney Rule, which was introduced in the Football League, I think it was last year, where clubs are obliged to at least interview one candidate from a BAME, and BAME is not a word I'm a big fan of, background for managerial positions. But many have found ways around this. There is a loophole that can be exploited, so they don't have to do that. And I wonder if the same thing might happen here. But it is a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, Barry Glendenning.
You're very welcome, Faye Carruthers.
I look forward to see you dancing in your living room again soon. Nick Ames, always a pleasure. Wave at me next time.
I look forward to blanking you again soon, Faye.
I'll wear a balaclava, then you'll have an excuse. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Faye. Always a pleasure to be with you as well.
See you at a football league ground near you soon. So we never did actually get to debate exactly where Max Rushton was on his mini break. I knew all along. And an island retreat with Kim Kardashian. He's back with you on Thursday after sunning himself.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.